Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post a Zolt in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post a Zamorin at DungeonsMaster.com. And welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week. Hey everyone, welcome to D&D Encounters, Season 14, Search for the Diamond Staff. Today we start Chapter 2, Session 4, The Ghost Hold. The characters, after last session, have followed Feodel from the note of Feodel, you find that they are supposed to go to Battledale, to go to Sandersall Manor. There they meet the Sembian Barcero, either fight it out, talk it out, however your table went, and we have both tonight. So, Derek, Craig, welcome again.
Hello. Welcome. Thanks for having us, as usual.
Yes, definitely. All right, so how do we want to get started? I know that Toronto this week had quite a bit of rain, and I know your session on Monday got canceled due to power outages and floods and the whole kit and caboodle, right, Derek?
And yep. Craig. Yep. We, and Mother Nature doesn't work around our D&D games as much as we'd like her to, and unfortunately our game had to be rescheduled. So we'll do a double next week, but that just meant we got one less session to talk about. Fortunately, Silver Snail session ran business as usual tonight. I ran a table with six players using the D&D Next rules. Unfortunately, though, Craig didn't play or run a session at all.
Indeed.
Sadly.
So he's here to fill some commentary.
Well, I came ready to run 4th edition, but I wasn't sure if one of the DMs I was filling in for at the Snail wasn't sure if he was going to be there, but he ended up making it, so he ran it.
Yeah. So, and Mark, you ran the session. Your group's all caught up now?
Yes. I finished up the second or the third session, and that went really well. And the fourth session, well, we managed to finish that also, so it was quite interesting. So we'll have some stuff there to talk about.
Excellent.
So how about you get started?
Yeah, so why don't I jump right in? So in anticipation of running this, obviously we run it at both stores. I took a page out of the week 3 session where the characters had to explore the orc caverns, and a map was not provided for the entire cavern. The map was just provided for, the area where you're most likely to have combat. And as a result, the DMs had to sort of wing it and use theater of the mind. Or I know a lot of DMs just sort of drew out their own maps. And after we talked about it, after the last session, after we just, talked about what we had each done, and I read some of the posts online, it got me thinking, with this week's encounter, it was sort of more of the same in the sense that there was potential to explore an entire manor house before getting to the backyard where the stables and the courtyard is, where potentially you could have combat. So I decided to sketch out a little map of a manor house. Again, I just went online. I typed D&D manor house, and it gave me a whole bunch of pictures. I picked one that was very simple, sort of used that as my starting point. And then I posted it in the forums a couple of days ago, and a few of the other DMs sort of jumped onto that idea and posted variations of their own. And by the time I was ready to run it tonight, I had a pretty good, what I thought was a pretty good sketch of a very simple manor house. And I made sure to have all the rooms that were described in the adventure. And, when the party arrived, I simply put down the map that I had drawn and said, this is the house. And I didn't place any additional emphasis on where they should or should not go. And that way, I didn't telegraph, oh, you need to go to the backyard, by throwing out the full scale map right at the beginning. And as it worked out, the party spent, 45 minutes to an hour into adventure before we actually got to the part where they had to interact with the NPCs. Before that, it was exploration of the house and a little bit of role play at the beginning, sort of tying up loose ends from the week before. And it seemed to be going really well. And then when they got to the backyard where the map is, they had their interaction with the NPC. What was his name again?
Barcero,
thank you. And only two of the PCs were out there at the time. Like, they had sort of split up and divided among the house, and they were all sort of doing different things. So Becerro seemed – I had him originally played as, like, someone with some confidence because, I mean, he knew he had all his guards and the undead and the Shatter Kai there. So when he only saw two guys, he's like, oh, yeah, you know, an air of confidence about himself. And so they had a brief exchange, and then a couple of the other PCs – realizing something was going on, they could hear voices, but they couldn't make out specifics. They started to move a little closer, and of course they completely flubbed their sneak checks, so they eventually came out. And the long and the short was that the first character that was discovered, the first two characters, it was a ranger and a fighter. The guy playing the ranger is very new to D&D. This is his first time he's ever played in this season of encounters, and he seems to be catching on to the combat pretty well, but he's very quiet guy. And he seems almost a little bit sort of lacks confidence at the gaming table. Like, I'm constantly trying to get him to come out of his shell. I'm like, well, what do you think you'd do? And he's like, I don't know. I'm like, are you going to go where this guy's going? Are you going to go on your own? I don't know. So I'm really trying to encourage him. So when he was the guy face to face with Becerro, I thought, perfect. I'll have him do a little bit of role playing here. And it's like, he's like, I just sort of keep quiet and let the other guy talk. And I was like, oh, well, whatever. I mean, different people play different ways. So. But in any case, the other player is very experienced, and the way he's been playing his fighter was as a I think he's got like a noble background or something. So he's like got an air of confidence about him, and he's got a high charisma. So he was able to do a little bit of chit chat, and he basically sold the story. He's like, oh, yeah, Fidel actually sent us here on her behalf. We're supposed to collect you and bring you and your group to the meeting place. And of course, Becerro's like, this is the meeting place. And they're like, no, this place has been compromised. It's not safe anymore. You need to come with us. She's at a different location. She didn't want to risk bringing the staff here. And so because they knew her name, because they talked about the staff, Becerro was like willing to listen to them, especially, and they weren't aggressive, obviously. So I had the guy make a check. After modifiers, he hit a 20. I was like, okay. I'm like, he's believing what you're saying, or he's at least willing to listen to what you're saying. And so they chit-chat a little bit more. And then one of the – I can't remember who it was. One of the guys started talking. They were saying, oh, it was the paladin. I was like, oh, do you worship a good – out of the game, I asked the guy playing the character. I'm like, do you worship a good deity? And he's like, yeah, of course. I go, would your holy symbols be very evident on your person, your chest plate or your shield or something? He's like, absolutely. Like, okay, that sort of gives Becerro a little bit of reason to pause, because he's like, you guys have said you're mercenaries, but, you know, this seems out of character for a paladin. So I had the guy make like a bluff check, and he did a pretty good job of it. And then I had Becerro come around and sort of was like, he suspected something might be going on, but he didn't necessarily think it was the PCs pulling a fast one. He thought it more likely it was Fidel running off with the staff, which is what the adventure suggests you could do. And so he's like, look, if you guys are who you say you are, and Fidel has indeed hired you, she would have paid you with this interim coin. Do you how much did she pay you? How much coin do you have? And so the guys, they pooled all their money together. They only had about 100 GP of this interim coin that they had taken from the orcs. And so they're like, oh, yeah, she paid us 100 GP. And I sort of had that send Becerro off the deep end. He's like, holy crap, like clearly she didn't care if you guys completed this job or not. I'm like, 100 GP, that's nothing, that's peanuts. Like, she's obviously sent you here to distract me and send me in the wrong direction, because his reasoning was, if she was serious and wanted you to bring me somewhere, she would have paid you enough money to know that you would have followed through with the job. And you know, the fact that she only threw you guys 10 or 15 gold pieces each means that she doesn't really care if you complete the job. And so, of course, the players caught right onto that. And they're like, oh, man, we got taken. We could have earned more than this. Oh, man, we got played. And a couple of them made like bluff and perform checks, and they rolled really good. So they're like, oh, yeah, Becerro seems he's picking up on your genuine feelings of betrayal against Fidel. And so eventually he was just like, you know what? She's got the staff. This is where I know she's got to be going with it. And then he basically just calls his dudes and he's like, okay, everybody saddle up. We're heading out right now. Meanwhile, the PCs were like, you know what, dude, we've been riding all day long. We're going to camp out here. We'll catch up to you tomorrow. And he's like, okay, suit yourself. And so they managed to avoid combat altogether. They, They spend about 90 minutes from start to finish between the exploration of the house and then the role play in the back in the courtyard. It was a pretty good session, all things considered.
So what did you, just out of curiosity, I like the idea of the mansion, that you spend probably an hour doing mansion tie-ups and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff did your players do in the mansion? I mean, I know there's only so much that you can explore, right? I mean, it's you don't get anything around there, but what kind of stuff did they come up with, or what kind of stuff did you come up with in the manor?
Well, I didn't really add that many more details. Like, the room that I drew up, and I'm going to post it with my blog post, only has 6 rooms. And I think 5 of them or 4 of them are described in the adventure. Like, again, I wanted a very simple blueprint. I didn't want to, you know, make an overly complicated map. But because they split up, I would sort of do a couple of rounds with each guy. And then I would say, okay, now hold that thought. And then I would go to the next guys and go, okay, what are you guys doing? And they would, you know, I tried to really embellish the descriptions. And I let them lead. Like, one guy was like, okay, go in this room. I want to search. And I'm like, okay, well, what are you searching for? Like, don't just say I'm making a search and do a roll. You know, you don't want me to just dump information on you. Tell me what you're looking for and how you're searching for it. And I'll feed that. And so that seemed to work really well. The description in the adventure says that the mansion had, at least the front part of the mansion, had been destroyed by fire. So because they ended up entering sort of towards the back, like as I described it, I said, look, there are numerous holes in the wall where over time the manor has been destroyed. Either someone's crashed through the wall or, Mother Nature has just done it. And so they ended up sort of entering through a little hole in the wall halfway down the map. And then they worked their way back towards the front of the house. So when they first got in, where they first entered was near the back. So I said, I'm like, it's clearly overrun. It's dirty. It's dusty. I go, it's sort of, you know, you almost can sense there's like maybe some soot in here. But they didn't really play up the whole fire angle. And then when they started to move towards the front of the house, I started saying like, okay, now you can tell there was definitely a fire raged on here. And when they got to the tower, I had the tower attached to the library, and I described it as, you know, they went in the library and they're like, oh, we searched through. Are there any old books? And I'm like, guys, fire. The books would have been they would have gone up in flame. Like, no chance they would have survived. I go, you can also, and then they're like, oh, well, we make some search checks and we want to see what's going on. Just want to maybe figure out what's been happening here. And so I explained to them, again, following their lead, that other people, good guys and bad guys, have probably stayed in this house as a stopover during long journeys. I said, clearly you could see signs where people have searched, maybe looking for secret passageways or hidden compartments. I'm like, this room has been ransacked numerous times by numerous people. If there was anything of value here, it is long gone. And then when you describe the tower, I said, well, the tower looks like it's going to fall over. And you can make a check to determine if it's structurally sound. So the guy who rolled the check only rolled like a 6. And I'm like, well, you're pretty sure that it could, although it stood a number of years, it could topple over with the wrong weight on the wrong step, or you lean against the wall funny. Like, basically, I went to the opposite extreme, right? Although it does say it's structurally sound, because he flubbed the roll, I'm like, you're convinced it's very dangerous. And so the other guy playing a halfling rogue, he's like, well, I'm a light guy, and I think I'm going to go in and search it anyway. And so I described it to them. I said, well, think of it this way. This room's been ransacked. However, if other people have made the same assumptions about the tower that you have made, they may not have ventured up to the second level, and there might still be some swag up there. But if you flub some rolls, you could get crushed. And the guy playing the halfling role was like, I'm pretty chaotic. I think I'd do it. Meanwhile, the other guys were like, no, don't go. Don't go. So, of course, he goes up. I had to make some checks, which really were just for flavor. Like, it didn't matter if he failed the checks. It wasn't nothing was going to happen. But he didn't know that. And then I had to make a couple of checks. He found a random magic item, which I had him roll, and he actually rolled healing potion, and then he found the silver necklace. And then later in the adventure, I had the Shatter Kai. After the role-playing had started in the backyard, these two characters were still in the front of the house. I had Basario send the Shatter Kai. He's like, go search the house and see if there's anyone else about. And the Shatter Kai overheard them talking, where the guy's like, look what I found upstairs, a potion and a silver necklace. It's got to be worth some money. And the Shatter Kai sort of shows up, and he's like, we have your friends. Come with me, and you'll remain unharmed. And so unfortunately, the players, knowing what was happening and their friends weren't really in danger, were like, yeah, okay, we go with them, no problem. And so I'm like, oh, you're not going to attack them or anything? Nope. So I'm like, okay. I go, he demands that you give him that treasure. He's like, that belongs to me. And they're like, what do you mean? You're just going to steal it from us? And he goes, no, my group's already laid claim to this place. Anything found here belongs to us. And then they're like, okay. So they just handed over the swag. They didn't argue. They didn't fight. Nothing. And so I was like, okay, well, if you're not going to put up a fight, he's going to take advantage of you guys because you're sissies. So, yeah, they just handed over the loot. And then when the bad guys took off, the one guy was like, oh, we forgot to get our stuff back. And I was like, oh, well, there goes your treasure off on a horse.
Oh, my goodness.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so they were like, oh, well. And it's funny because the two guys, one was a wizard who, like, he's got not a lot of hit points. His defenses are really low, and he's taken some really bad hits over the last couple weeks. The other guy's a rogue who's very, very soft. So of all the party to be separated, these two guys, like the Shatterkai would have destroyed them. And I had the Shatterkai use that power where he can teleport and then he gets resistance to all damage until the end of his next turn. So basically he teleported in and he sort of like threatened them. And I thought, well, if they try and attack him, he won't take any damage anyway. So, but they're like, no, okay, we go with them. It's like, okay, no problem, guys. So, no, it worked out well. And I said to the players at one point, we were a little bit over an hour into it when they got to the point where it could have potentially gone into a fight. And the one guy actually sort of said offhand comment, oh, I guess we need to get ready for combat now. And so I said to them, like, look, guys, I know with encounters you come out every week, you expect to, you know, fight monsters. You expect to have a combat, and every week you do. But I said, we're using the D&D Next mechanic, which gives us plenty of options. And the fact that this encounter, the way it's set up, is you can get through it without combat. I said, I leave it to you guys to decide. But I said, I don't want anyone to go home and be upset that they didn't get to fight monsters this week. So I said, if you have your heart set in fighting something, we'll come up with a good reason for you to fight. And the table as a whole, the table was like, no, let's see where this goes. And if we screw things up, we'll fight. But if we can get through it without fighting, let's see if we can do that. And they made a few key roles when they needed to. I let the role playing guide the difficulty, and they ended up no combat. So they were very happy that not only did they get no combat, but the fact that they didn't have to expend any resources, because that's been a real challenge for this group, because I haven't been giving them the extended rests. So they did the whole first chapter without any rests, and it was really tough on them. So they were very happy to know that they've only got to do two more encounters before they get their rest, instead of three encounters before they get their rest. And they're going to go in next week with a full repertoire of everything, full healing, full hit points, full spells, everything. So, you know, they and a couple of them even said, they go, this was really fun. We had a good time. So I was glad to hear it. Cause, you know, you're always concerned that people probably have a certain expectation. If they don't get it, they might be upset. But no, people seem to like the idea that not everything has to end up into a fight.
I like that. That's the way that I play D&D.
Yeah. In a home game, absolutely, I do. But again, with encounters, I don't want anyone to feel they've been cheated.
Yeah, no. Some people have that sort of built-in expectation.
True.
Well, true. Especially, like I said, we've got one guy at our table. He's pretty new. And, you know, it's clear that he's not yet comfortable enough to be an outgoing role-playing kind of guy. I mean, the way he's playing his character is fine. But clearly, he didn't really get to do a lot this week. I mean, his character, he made some significant checks during the search of the house. But, you know, I mean, I know there are players like that they just want to come and kill monsters. So you got to make sure that you're working towards what everyone wants.
Exactly.
So anyway, that was a long, drawn-out explanation of what happened. How did things go in Elliott Lake this week?
Well, you pretty much summed it up. No, I'm kidding. I know that last week we'd spoken and I hadn't finished the combat yet at that point. So they had engaged, they were just basically had started, I guess you would say, the combat. The orcs and the zents were talking and they were negotiating and they were talking back and forth and saying, oh, well, you know, you ripped us off. No, we should get more money and all that kind of stuff. And then the rogue just decided at the start, said, you know what? I'm going to go in. Yes, orcs. You guys should have gotten a lot more money. And all of a sudden, everybody was like, whoa, up in arms, right? Like, who's these guys? We didn't hear them coming, right? They wrote stellar stealth checks, the whole group. And the rogue goes in and says, you know what? These ents are these mercenaries are trying to rip you off. They're talking about, you know, you've lost some great numbers. We should know we killed most of your numbers because we're getting paid more. We're looking for this diamond staff also. If you would have come peacefully, and he's going on and on. He says, we would have gone peacefully. you know, we understand that you are very powerful and you've lost so many people. These people should pay you more. And the Zents are like, no, we're not going to pay them anymore. Look, give us the diamond staff, they said, or tell us what happened to the diamond staff. And all we want is the knowledge inside the vault. You know what's going on. And we'll give you the rest of the gold. And they couldn't believe it, right? So they didn't believe it at first. And they said, look, here's some faith. I have 50 gold pieces to give the orcs if you let them go, or you basically just ignore the Zents, tell us where the diamond staff is, and we'll be on our way, and we'll bring it back to you. So the orcs were like humming and hawing, and all of a sudden the mage said, this is ridiculous. And then the Zents drew their swords to try and go after the party, and the orcs took it as the Zents, you know, as a hostile African Zents.
Nice.
So, right, it was fantastic, because then combat lasted, what, a whole 15 minutes or so, with the orcs jumping on one of the soldiers. The ranger came around, went around in the back way. Like, if you see the map, it goes all the way around. Back way, they attacked the mage from there. The mage went invisible. We didn't have a ruling to find invisible creatures, but we did a spot check versus a wisdom check, and I gave like a +3 or +5 bonus to the wizard because he was invisible. But the ranger managed to see him and knock him out in his next attack, which is great. So they knocked out the mage, knocked out one of the Zent soldiers, killed another one, and at the end the orcs were like, okay, now you give us money. Well, they said, whoa, whoa, well, we haven't gone, we don't have the diamond staff yet. We haven't gone, we haven't been able to get, we don't have the treasure from the vault yet. We need the diamond staff. They said, well, you bring gold back, right? I kind of made like, you know, the less intelligent type being, because Kazakh was not exactly the most brilliant of
not the sharpest orc in the
exactly. So the players didn't want to have to deal with the prisoners, the mage and the soldier. So they told the orcs, they said, well, you keep these guys prisoner until we come back and bring you your gold, and then we'll bring you your gold, you give us the prisoners back, and we'll deal with them from there. They said, okay, deal. So they gave them the 50 gold. They pulled together 50 gold as part of a bluff, and the orcs took it. They were allowed to go on their way, and the mage basically found Fidelity's letter, and they rested up. They went back to Hap, told Imani what was going on, said, we don't have time to chat, so we're taking off now, and we got to go to the manor. So they went to the manor, and very similar to you, Derek, I put the map out, though, but I told them that...
Sorry, you know, the map that came with the adventure, or...?
The map that came with the adventure. And you know how you had the... If you look at the bottom part of the map, you have kind of part of the tower that's there, part of the mansion that's there?
Yeah.
Well, we did Theater of the Mind from there. So I started them. We have a long table out at the store. And I put the map out a bit, and I told the characters, you guys are here. So let's say a computer width apart, like a laptop width apart from the actual line of the map. I said... Right now, you're at the front of the house. You've come in with your horses, and you look around, and you see this big property. Most of it's burned down, but you do see that it extends in the back. There are a couple structures around, and I didn't explain what they were yet. So they said, okay, well, we go in cautiously. So they went through the front door, and just like you, did some form of exploration, except they decided they did the smart thing. Some of them are seasoned D&D players. They stuck together.
Yeah.
All right, they stuck together, and similarly with the tower, they rolled stellar wisdom checks to see whether or not the tower was going to fall, but it went off without a hitch. It didn't take as long as I thought, but we did more of a theater of the mind, and they really actually enjoyed that, because then it even forced me to say, okay, well, this room is probably about, you know, 30 feet by 20 feet. You can tell it's the main hall. Most of it's collapsed. There's a lot of rubble all over the place, but you do see straight ahead. You see a kitchen that's mainly intact, right? I think I had the manor set up differently than you did. I had the front away from the carriage house.
Whereas, yeah, so did I.
Yeah, but okay.
I'll post the map.
You can take a look. But very similarly, we did a theater of the mind, and the players seemed to really, really enjoy that. And then all of a sudden, some person said, well, I'm going to do a perception check. I want to see what's around here. So he was actually had his mini right by one of the holes in the wall on the map. And I gave him the light, seeing that Barcero and his goons were there. And the player basically said, hey, everybody, come here. Look, there's people out there. So they tried to move stealthily. Paladin rolls his check, or the cleric rolls his check. Cleric looks at me, he goes, I move so silently that I take my sword and start banging it against my shield. I'm like, nice. So totally failed his stealth check. So you see Berserker come out with the Dread Warriors, and all of a sudden you see the Shatterkai erupt. Like, I had them kind of spread out in a half circle all along the back courtyard and the court and the carriage house. And from there, I was like, okay, so you see these guys, they kind of have a dark tinge to them. Not skin dark, but more almost like a shadowy image. And they have scars all over their face. And they're tattooed all over the place. And they have these chains. They have these chains, these two-handed chains in their hands. And they're just looking at you quite... Actually, sorry. I started them off really tame, right? The chains are, you know, strapped around their chests and stuff like that. And I said, you see this. Not one decided to do a nature check or do a planes check or an intelligence check or any kind of check whatsoever. I'm like, really? I said, these guys are deadly. I'm thinking to myself. And then all of a sudden, I say, cleric, you see across the way, you see a man, but he's surrounded by undead. And these undead are soldier-like creatures. And he goes, oh, I want to attack them. But then Barcero introduces himself as a Sembian. He's a sage from Sembia. And, you know, he's like, well, who are you? They said, oh, well, Fideli sent us to just like you, to fetch you, to bring you to see the Diamond Staff. Like, right away, he saw through the guy. He's like, look, you're not wearing anything Zentirium. You're not wearing a Zed. You're not carrying anything that would happen to be something from Fideli. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, you know what? We're after her because we want the Diamond Staff. Berserker says, well, Berserker says, well, what's your interest in the Diamond Staff? You seem to know a lot about it. And then they kind of said, well, what do you want it for? He says, well, you know what? We're all sages here. I know Imani had the staff, so I hired somebody to go get it. Well, you know they slaughtered a bunch of innocent people in Happy. He says, well, I just know Fideli's reputation. She has a great reputation, and she gets the job done. I said, I don't know how she does it or what kind of methods she takes. I don't ask. Which leaves me innocent. And the cleric pipes up and goes, well, you're not so innocent. You killed so many innocent people. He says, look, I'm not here to argue semantics with you. As you can see, I have my revived minions here in front of me. So I'm not going to argue semantics with you, cleric. He says, all I know is I want the Diamond Staff. And then the cleric's like, well, okay, well, what's your interest in the Diamond Staff then? He says, well, you should know. There's a lot of lore to be had. He says, all I want is a Diamond Staff. He says, I'll pay you handsomely if you go get it. Because I assume at this point that Fideli is so late that betrayed me. Yeah, has double-crossed me. So I will pay you handsomely. And then one of the other guys, the ranger, pipes up and says, no, we work for Imani. We're going to get the staff for Imani. I'm like face-palming. I said, combat is imminent, right? I'm face-palming. I'm saying... He says, well, if you're going to have it this way, he says, but I'll pay you twice what Imani's going. But they're mostly good characters, right? So they said, you know what? Forget it. We're going to get this Diamond Staff. And they turn to leave. And Becerro says, you know what? Forget it. And he says, attack them. Do not let them leave. Because, once again, knowledge is power, right? And so combat starts. So Becerro gets to go first. And he launches, what was it, this death smoke. Yeah. A point you could see within 50 feet, and that was fantastic because it caught every single character in it, and three of them failed and still did damage on a pass save, right? So they took a lot of damage on the first round. So they move out of the cloud. The wizard goes to cast web, but I said, you can't see where you're going because you're standing right in front of the cloud or right behind the cloud. You cannot see through that to place your web anywhere on the ground. So he's like, oh, crap. I said, on top of that, you're feared, so you have to spend a standard. You have to spend your action to try and become unfeared or back to normal, or what do you want to call it? So then rogue and the ranger decide, okay, well, we're going to take on these guys, right? They're just little humans with little spike chains. Then the Shatterkai went, and they just basically almost leveled them. They had them down to 75 or 25% hit points by the end of the first round. Because I don't know if it's the same in the 4th edition. I didn't even look at the 4th edition stats. But it says that they have the Dance of Death, right? So if the chain fighter moves at least 15 feet or uses Shadow Jaunt, it can make a spike chain attack at the end of its movement. So that's part of his movement. So then on top of that, they get to use their melee attack, the spike chain melee attack. So they hit every single time. My dice were on fire. No critical hits, but the dice were on fire. And I hit them both both times. And on top of that, next round, their Shadow Jaunts both recharged. So it was pretty deadly for a bit. But then the cleric got rid of his fear, and the cleric decided, you know what, I'm not even going to try and engage these guys in melee, and he uses a channel divinity to turn undead. All nice. Three dread protectors gone.
Nice.
Fear
nice.
And ran. And so combat just from there just kind of went downhill. The Shadarkai, one of the Shadarkai just decided to ditch Becero. And Becero was left all alone. And at that point, the party did not kill him. They basically sent him off. The cleric's lawful good, so he was playing a lawful good character. Handed him into the authorities, and that's where we ended it off.
Nice. You reminded me of something when you said that he called their bluff when they're like, "Hey, you don't look like Xantarim. You don't have the symbols or anything on you." I actually used the same line when I did mine, and they were all like, "Of course we don't have Xantarim symbols. We're mercenaries. We'll work for anybody. We don't want to align ourselves with any one group. That'd be bad for business." And I was like, "Oh," and then that's when he's like, "Well, but if you're working for the Xantarim, then and they had the letter. They're like, besides, Fidel gave us this letter, so we know where to find you." And so they showed guy had printed up the letter as a handout the previous week, and so the one guy still had it, and so he hands it back to me, and I was like, "Oh," but Sarah was like, "Yep, this is in my handwriting. It even includes the misspelling because I had made a typo in there, and they made fun of me last week because there was a typo." So I was like, "Yep, this is mine. Here's where I made a spelling mistake."
That's cool. So if they would have done something like that, that would have changed everything completely. Yeah. But they didn't. They just kind of went in and went, "Oh, okay, yeah, well, okay, well, we want the staff." I mean, they couldn't think of anything off the top of their heads. It was a lot of fun, though. But just like you, the combat, our whole night lasted probably about 2 hours, 15 minutes with the end of our combat session and the exploration and everything. But it was a lot of fun. I have to admit that this session was great. I love the setup.
Yeah, I really liked that it was open-ended. Like, it wasn't just, you got to go in, you got to kill the monsters. Now, fortunately, with my group, one of the guys, actually, the guy who ended up doing the talking, as luck would have it, I prompted them to make knowledge checks, which I usually do in 4th edition as well. I said, if you guys want to give me checks, potentially you can learn something about them. And he rocked those checks. So he knew, like, that it gave you basically in the conversion kit, it tells you if they make a check of this difficulty, they know the following details. And so once he realized how powerful these bad guys potentially were, he was that much more motivated to talk his way through rather than fight his way through. Mm-hmm. And I said to the other characters, I'm like, "You, the player, have heard me provide this to this guy, but you, your characters wouldn't know this." So I said, try to make sure that you act accordingly. And I mean, some players are better at that than others, but I think they did a reasonable job of sort of, just basically saying, "Look, we're going to trust the man in the room. He was the first guy there. He's the guy who's building this rapport. We're just going to back his play no matter how it goes." And but they said after, they're like, had combat broken out, they probably wouldn't have realized how powerful the monsters were until a couple of rounds in. Whereas the one guy was like, he would have had a much better tactical idea of who to attack and how to attack and stay away from this guy and, focus on that guy. So anyway, it's interesting. Yeah, no, it worked. It worked well.
But did you use the power in the same way? I know that we had a discussion earlier about the Dance of Death by the Shadarkai.
I honestly, because we didn't get into combat, I didn't have to.
You didn't have to
look at
it.
The stats, but I did look at them after, like in preparation for this call, because you had mentioned how it worked. And yeah, from my reading, I think you're correct because it says the guy gets to move and make an attack. So the way it's worded to me, that is, sounds like the attack is a part of a special move. And it sounds like he can do the special move every time. So the only way I can see to counter that is if a player uses a spell that basically slows the I think the Chill Touch, the cantrip, does that. So if the wizards are using Chill Touch, it limits their movement to 10 feet. And the power specifically says they have to move 15 feet or more. So I guess that was sort of the balance, right? Is if you've got a wizard who has Chill Touch and realizes that this power is based on their mobility, that it basically saps them of that second attack. But gotta think, a wizard is less, I think that Chill Touch is literally, it's a touch, right? They gotta come right up next to them. So I can't see a wizard walking right up to put himself at that kind of risk with the hope that, "Oh, well, this round I'm only gonna take one attack instead of two." it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, those Shadarkai were pretty nasty in third. That's probably my favorite monster so far in this next.
Well, I was, again, although I didn't actually do the combat, I was very concerned that this fight was going to just crush the party, because the undead, it says there's three undead, and it says that they have total resistance to, or they have resistance to piercing, slashing, and bludgeoning. Basically, you must use magic weapons or magic spells. Only one guy in our party has a magic weapon, and that's because he played in the game day. None of the other guys have magic weapons, because, I mean, it's a magic light system. And now, fortunately, there are a couple other characters in the party. There's a wizard, a cleric, and a paladin, and a ranger even. Not that the ranger has offensive magic, but, you know, so they had some magic at their disposal, but I think it would have been really ugly. Like, I think they would have burned through a lot of their stuff this week, and it really would have made the subsequent weeks incredibly difficult. So I'm sort of glad that things worked out the way they did. I mean, I think they're still going to have a tough time of the next couple of sessions, but... You know, I'm glad that they're going in with an advantage as opposed to coming in and saying, "Oh, geez, look, we've used all our best stuff."
I still can't believe they gave up their magic item though.
That's hilarious.
Well, I think it had been more than a potion, they probably would have put up a bigger stink.
Right.
But the fact that it was a potion, and the fact that they had found potions the week before, I think they were sort of like, "Oh, well, we don't really need it." But yeah, when the party finds himself in a position that a healing potion would make a big difference, I'm going to go, geez, it's too bad that Shatterkai stole the healing potion from the party, you know, sort of to remind them that things could have been better if you had put up a little bit of a fight for it. So
yeah, but Becero shows up in your mind and wiggles that potion in front of your face.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he doesn't have it. The Shatterkai have it, but yeah, same idea. You know, somebody other than you has it. Or more importantly, it's like, oh, you're fighting the Shatterkai. He pulls out a healing potion, which you recognize, and he drinks it. Oh, now you got to fight through all those extra hit points.
Your fingerprint scan reveals your fingerprints on that healing potion.
Or he reaches into his pocket, and as he pulls out a potion, a silver necklace falls to the floor, and you realize, that's the healing potion. Glug, 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 regains all these hit points.
That would have been a kicker.
Well, I still may do that. Again, I'm going to read ahead to the next couple of weeks and sort of figure out if it makes sense to have some of these guys reappear, either in place of monsters that are already listed or in addition to. Because as it is now, they're not exactly opposed to the group they encountered tonight. Like they, and that's what they said. They go, hey, if we meet up with them again, we should really play up that we're on his side. So... Anyway, we'll see how it plays out, depending on what choices they make. And, yeah. I mean, we're halfway, right? It's an 8-week adventure. This is week 4. So the players are starting to get the hang of the system. The players are starting to get the hang of their characters. And, yeah, we'll go from there.
That's one of the parts I really liked about this encounter was the assumption that, like, when you read it, it wasn't just assumption that it's going to end up in a fight. It's very much that he's genuinely surprised to have visitors and it's not a hostile tone that's taken right away.
Very true. I played up Barcero as being very cordial, to tell you the truth. I didn't play him up as overly
suspicious
ambitious
or angry. Yeah, no, I was the same way.
A douche. Although, he wasn't even a douche. Like, essentially, he just came out and said, "Hey, friends."
Yeah, that was sort of my thing as well. As I had him come out, I said he's cautious, but at the same time, he's not aggressive.
Right.
Yeah.
Because again, the way I described the setting before I even got there was, you know, I said, think of it like an old mining town, 30s, 40s, 50s out in the Western U.S. They, you know, you got all these miners that come out for the gold rush, and then suddenly there's no more gold. Everybody leaves and you've got a complete town that just goes to rot. I said, that's basically what this is. There's this whole area of the Dales that used to be, you know, inhabited by very wealthy people. And for whatever reason, they're not here anymore. And so anyone traveling through knows about these locations. So I said, you never know who you're going to encounter here. So there's sort of that mutual respect. And at the same time, it's like, well, your claim isn't any better than my claim. So let's not necessarily fight about it. And so, you know, having that sort of as part of the setup a half hour, an hour earlier, I think that sort of helps set the tone. Although I did give the characters, you know, when Becero came out and he's like, hey, who are you? The one guy who didn't want to really interact, he was the one who flubbed his sneak check while he was out by himself. And he's like, I don't want to say anything because I know my party's just behind this door and they'll come out and do the talking. I said, okay, but how do you I said, your body language is gonna give him information. So I said, what do? Do you take like a defensive stance, an aggressive stance? Do you sort of act casual? Do you, you know, hands at your side, not near their weapons, hands on sword hilt? Like I said, you describe to me how you're doing it. And you know, the player basically got into it a little bit. He's like, you know, I want to make sure that he knows I'm not aggressive, but he says at the same time, I want to make it clear that, you know, if I need to fight, I can. And I was like, well, he can see your equipment, so he knows you clearly, you know, you're armed. And, you know, so we sort of played up that a little bit. But now I got a question for you guys. It kept describing the guy as Sembian from Sembia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I didn't understand how they would know that. Like, are the Sembians supposed to be a different race? Do they? And that's what I said. I'm like, do they have a third eye growing out of their forehead? Like, what would make him distinct?
I don't know what it would make it distinct, but I think whenever I saw those kind of descriptions, and I think that also came in last week when Barcero's name appeared on the letter, because that's a Sembian name, right? And I figured if your character is from the area or has something related to Sembia, like if someone has come with some sort of like Forgotten Realms intensive backstory and they do have some sort of tie to Sembia in some manner, then, you know, I think that's a sort of a tee off for them. And if you as a DM will know, this guy I know is, you know, has some Sembian ties, and you can probably let them know that they recognize that.
Well, I took it as Sembians are seafarers, pretty much. There's a description at the start of the module also that talks about Sembians. They talk about the Zents and the Sembians because it's all interrelated, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand their political role. Like, I've read a lot of the novels. I've even read there was the whole series that took place in Sembia. But I don't know. The way it was written, it was almost like, you know, like there was supposed to be some visually, ethnically different. Like, do they have dark skin? Do they have, you know, is there something, you know, do they all have red hair? Like, is it something that's a unique trait that you can clearly say, like again, in real life, you meet a guy and you go, this is an Asian guy. Okay, well, there's certain characteristics when you describe them using that term that immediately come to mind that I can say, okay, you know, this guy's from China, this guy's from America. Chances are I can tell which is which just by looking at them. You know, there's physical differences. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was trying to think of with this Sembia. Like, is there something we're supposed to be reading into this that the characters being from the world would clearly know, like, oh, Sembians have dark skin. Okay, that's what's tipping you off. This guy is clearly Sembian. Or is it, like Craig was saying, it's just there's something about them, whether it's the style of their clothes or the way they have, you know, a funny accent or something, that if your character has spent any time in Sembia, you're going to, you know, you can immediately pick it up.
Well, that's what I kind of went with the way he was dressed, his attire. I didn't necessarily describe it, but I said he's got very, very rich robes. But he's a little, it didn't describe him very well, but I said he's a little fat, pot-bellied. I was thinking like a Buddha in a robe, right?
Nice.
So that's what I was thinking. And he had braided hair and with beads and stuff. So that's how I picture it. I picture it kind of like a seafaring, almost kind of like a cross between Buddha and what was Jack from Pirates of the Caribbean? Like the kind of dreadish type hairstyle.
Right.
Sure. So he was one of those type of guys, and he had undead with him. So I when I read the Shadowfar, the Netherrealm, and all that kind of stuff, I thought, you know, kind of necromantic, very politically strong, powerful, and that's how I kind of pictured him, is kind of like a dreaded Buddha with undead guardians. So Sembian, everybody from the Dales at that point would know that he's from Sembia just based on his look, and that's mm-hmm. how I described him.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's no incorrect way to do it. I felt like there was a missing, some detail was missing for me that would have made my life a little easier if they had just added, you know, one or two more lines to just say, hey, FYI, he's from Sembia, and this is the reason why you would know that. But I mean, again, I guess you make the game your own, right? So
yeah, and I think that's certainly a strong theme in this one. Like with the, you know, with the manor, it's just they don't give you a definite, this is how the manor looks. Like, here's a picture of the whole manor. You just do it yourself.
Yeah.
Here's the descriptions of what's in there. And that's why I really like that part of this, because last encounter had the different, the cave like chasms and whatnot, right? But there wasn't quite, didn't feel like there's that quite enough. But this one felt like there was more stuff to explore, more stuff to look into. And I really like your idea of putting that map down, so it's not like, okay, and then you enter this room and, oh, hold on, let me pull out the big map now. And you know, so it wasn't like, okay, well, here's combat time. It kind of just flowed a little more organically, I guess.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, we've been running this for 14 seasons. When I actually think about this before I run a game, I always feel proud of myself, because usually we don't think of it until after we run it. We're like, you know what would have made this better? If we had taken 5 seconds and done this, and we're like, oh, well, we're stupid. Why didn't we think of that? So I was all proud of myself for thinking of it ahead of time. And I got to say, the feedback that I got on the forums, or again, it was just two or three people made a couple of additional comments. One guy sort of redrew the map with just changed a couple of the little details I had thrown out there. And it's like, it's amazing how just a little bit of collaboration, you get a couple of DMs putting their heads together, and I even replied back. I'm like, it's amazing how the online community can take a good idea and make it a great idea with just a few little extra details.
Yeah.
And I think that really, really added to the way that this week's encounter played out, because had I not had this kind of map, or had I not been willing to draw something up on the fly, like the exploration phase would have taken probably 5 minutes. Would have just been like, okay, there's a couple of rooms you can look through, this, this, and this, make some checks, blah, 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 done. Although, while I'm thinking about it, the guy who's playing the paladin, he went into the kitchen. And that was the first room they went in where I didn't describe everything as being completely destroyed. I was like, yeah, there's still some stuff in here that would have survived the fire that didn't get looted. And he's like, oh, yeah, like what? I was like thinking off the top of my head, okay, what wouldn't have been destroyed in a fire?
A turkey baster?
I go, there's like some cast iron frying. I go, there's a couple of pots and pans, like maybe a big cast iron frying pan. He goes, really? I take it. I was like, you take a cast iron frying pan? He goes, hey, we might come across monsters that are only affected by cold iron. And I was like, okay, I'll give that to you. No problem. And then one of the other guys is like, wouldn't it be all rusted? I'm like, no. The people who lived here were rich. Their servants would have known, like, you got to put oil on those cast iron so they don't rust out. And I was like, oh, no. And everyone at the table's like, yeah, I have a cast iron frying pan in real life. I know all about how to take care of my cast iron frying pan. So we got into this little tangent where everyone was talking about cast iron frying pan. So when the paladin actually flubbed his sneak check, he had just come from the kitchen. And so I'm like, yeah. He rolled like a 2 or something. And I'm like, oh, you dropped a cast iron frying pan. It's like, bang, bang, bang. And I was like, he's like, oh, man. But he picked it back up and he kept it. So I'm kind of hoping down the road that I haven't looked at the monster list, but I'm like, I may have to adjust it if it's not in there, because I'm sure there are monsters that are only either only affected by cold iron or that take extra damage.
Usually they're demons or ghosts, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's certain creatures, and fae creatures sometimes are like that as well. So I was like, I got to give them a chance to use that frying pan as an impromptu weapon for sure.
Well, I'm glad it wasn't a turkey baster, you said.
No. But even just the concept of having this high and mighty holy paladin coming armed with a frying pan into combat just is humorous. So I'm looking forward to, because I know this player, he's having a lot of fun with this guy. And so I can just see him saying, you know what? Ah, this sword is just not hitting any creatures. I drop the sword and I pull out the cast iron frying pan. And then knowing him, he'll roll a crit.
Yeah,
and
seriously.
That'll be it. That, he'll be using the frying pan from that point forward.
So. Oh, dude, you should have him using a during an extended rest, have it on the fire, and then take it out and start whacking people with a red hot frying pan. Nice. He takes 5 points of fire damage every round.
Strong point damage.
Yeah, seriously.
He's blinded because his eyes are sealed shut because he got hit by a frying pan.
Jeez. But I mean, this encounter felt like it could have been very, well suited to any kind of playing style. Because I think if the whole group really wasn't too into the role playing, you just wanted the combat. There's a pretty good combat in there. You could just go through room, already combat. But if you didn't want to do that, like with Derek's group, you could just role play through the whole thing, and it might not come to blows.
Well, I know one of the guys on the forums was saying that he was planning to do a sketch of the map, a map of the house, and then he was going to throw a couple other just random monsters that had moved into the house, and that's why the Sembians weren't in the house, is because when they got there, there was already a monster in there. And they're like, okay, you can have the house. We're going to go into the barn.
Yeah, because it does describe the manor as being layered to other beasts and whatnot over the years.
Yeah. And I think he was in the forums. I think he had said troll. Again, I don't know how that fits in the power structure of the D&D Next, but really, you could have it as any monster. I mean, the more of a brute, the more animalistic and primal it is, I think the better, because if it's something that could be reasoned with, is a good chance that the Sembians would have already done that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, like a troll or an owlbear or something that's just like, it's smart enough to know that if I don't attack you, you won't attack me, but it's big enough that they wouldn't have tried to displace it. They would have been like, yep, you take claim of the library. It's all yours.
You just have a displacer beast. There you go.
Yeah, or something. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, we talk about what would you do differently if you ran this encounter again? Well, if I was running this encounter again for, say, a home group where I wasn't limited by time and I knew the players well enough that I could throw some things at them, I would probably run this exactly like I ran it tonight, except I would probably have one or two monsters somewhere in the house. I like, Craig, I like your idea of maybe a displacer beast or two that sort of prowl through the house.
Yeah.
You know, whether they've come after the party or whether they were there originally, or yeah, just have like, there's an owl bear sleeping in the hallway under the steps, and they come in and the players don't make any effort to be quiet, and then the owl bear just roar.
Yeah, that would actually be really cool.
You know, or as we like to do with the owl bears, hoot hoot roar, hoot hoot roar.
Or just, I give
is that like claw claw bite?
Yeah, pretty much.
I give him a nice big surprise and have Dretch Royster layering there now.
Well, especially with all the new Reaper minis. It's like, and you see an undead dragon! And you pull it out. Like, oh my god, we run like hell.
Yeah, Dre, I just want an excuse to use this.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I played, I guess on a side note, but to do with this, is I was, as soon as you started mentioning, like, no time constraints and what would you do differently, I recently played on Neverwinter this Foundry quest. They have these little quests. Anyway, a side quest. And basically what it was this tavern that was run by zombies, smart zombies that have put illusions on themselves to make people think. And they pluck people once in a while. And then you go in the dungeon underneath, so kind of like an old mansion, right? I was thinking this. And the undead have like restaurant, and they have connoisseur undead that come over and eat these people's brains, right? So I was thinking something very similar as soon as you said, you know, no time constraints, whatever, home game, whatever. I was thinking, you know, make kind of like an undead cafeteria under the mansion. So that would have been cool, you know, steal one PC and that'd be like your goal is to get your PC back before he gets his brain extracted.
I like, that's a good adventure hook. I'm going to borrow that the next time I do a hook article. I hope you don't mind stealing your idea.
I thought it was really cool. The Foundry quest was really fun. So, yeah.
Yeah, because that's all user-created content, right?
It is.
Cool.
It is. So it was a lot of fun. But anyway, that's another tangent.
Yep. Okay, well, that was everything I can think of. Do you guys have anything else you want to add for this week?
No, I'm good. I talked at length, so.
Yeah, I talked more than my fair share. We'll let Craig talk next week.
Perhaps I will have something to talk about.
He spoketh. He spoketh. No, next week. Yep. All right. Well, guys, till next week, and everybody good gaming, and we'll touch back for session 5 next week.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
Excellent. So this concludes session 4, and next week we're going to talk on session 5 with the rogue agents. So that that's pretty mysterious to start off with, so.
Dun, 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 dun.
Could be rather scandalous.
Yep.
Ooh, scandal. Mm-hmm. Anyway, see you guys next week.
Yep. Yep.
See you then. You can follow me on Twitter at @Amaron_DM, and be sure to visit dungeonsmaster.com for original D&D 4th edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at 20foot and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D encounters. That's 20footradius20ftradius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.